This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. For people whose community and identity are viewed with suspicion by the dominant culture, it can be hard to feel fully part of where you live. For some, the instinct is to try to fit in as much as possible. For others, the impulse might be defiance or withdrawal. Sometimes those two urges can be present at different times in the same family, even in the same person. Ayad Akhtar is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and playwright. He's the author of the novel American Dervish, the plays Junk, The Who and the What, and The Invisible Hand, and the screenplay The War Within. He was recently named the new president of PEN America, the literary and human rights organization. He's drawn on his own experiences as a child of Pakistani immigrants to the U.S. and perceptions of Muslims in America. His latest novel, Homeland Elegies, is influenced by his own life story, including the ways that growing up in Wisconsin shaped his life. Ayad, thanks so much for joining us today.
No, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's talk about the autobiographical-ish nature of the book. It's drawing from your life story. It's not an autobiography. It is a novel, right?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to write a book that was going to collapse, you know, sort of do justice to the way truth and fiction have become collapsed in our public discourse. So the narrator has a lot of the facts of my life. He's got my name. But the book is a novel as well. So it's you know, it's playing fast and loose, and you're never quite sure what's real and what's not.
Now, you yourself, real Ayad, and I think book Ayad too, were born in New York, parents from Pakistan, raised near Milwaukee. Can you share some of your time in Wisconsin, what it was like growing up here?
Yeah, I grew up from the age of four until end of high school in just outside of Milwaukee in Waukesha County. It was great. I still go spend a lot of time in Wisconsin. I'm on the board at Milwaukee Rep, and my brother still lives he lives in St. Francis. So, you know, I loved being there. You know, I never really felt all that excluded. I felt like folks were very welcoming. You know, I think the state has changed a lot, really, since the era of Mr. Walker. The partisan divides have become a lot more vicious, and I think outsiders are a little bit less welcome. It seems to me every time I get back, it seems to have gotten a little worse. But growing up, it was nothing like that. And I think the only tribalism, I often joke, the only tribalism I ever saw growing up was if you didn't like the Green Bay Packers, then you were on the outs. So,
do you feel like an outsider now when you come back home?
No, I mean, I don't in the sense that I feel like I know the state so well, and I love Wisconsin, and I spend, you know, as I said, I spend a lot of time there. But it's clear to me that there is an antagonism toward folks who are perceived as outsiders, and it doesn't really, it's not even a racial thing at this point. I mean, it feels like it's if you're in Waukesha County, if you're an identifiable Democrat, you're worthy to get spit on.
Now, turning to your book, I think people looking at, say, the Pakistani community in the United States from the outside, or Muslims in America from the outside, might paint them with one broad brush. Maybe a positive way, maybe a negative way.
I doubt a positive way.
Okay.
I'm not sure about that.
But
anyway, what's the rest of your question?
Sorry. Oh, yeah. In your book, you portray a lot of variety in attachment to American identity, even in your book Mom and your book Dad, the way they think of the United States. Can you describe that tension to us?
Sure. Yeah. In the book, my dad, you know, and some of this is drawn, you know, obviously from my life and my father's life, was a real, you know, real rah-rah sort of American opportunist, in the sense of, you know, America was a land of opportunity, land of place to, you know, place to make yourself, make your name, self-made mythology and all of that, and was a very, very successful doctor. I mean, really one of the world specialists of arrhythmias, and turned a few clinics in Wisconsin into international destinations, you know, doing competition with Mayo Clinic. And my mom was, you know, a little bit more suspicious. I think she missed home a lot more. And I think she felt that a lot of the things that supposedly she was supposed to be enjoying in America that weren't really things that she liked as much as the stuff that she'd left behind. So I grew up kind of inside those two extremes. And my own experience of America obviously was very different because I was born here and I grew up here. So I was bringing a different picture of the country back home to them.
And in the book, you talk about visits to your parents' original homeland, Pakistan. What was it like for you, and how do you talk about that in the book, looking at Pakistan through the eyes of you born here in the United States?
Well, you know, I think that at one point is the only really extended section of the book is that takes place in Pakistan is in 2008. I go back, or the narrator goes back, and he's actually in the town of Abbottabad, which is the town where Osama bin Laden at the time is living and will be killed a few years later. And basically what the narrator says is that the picture that, you know, in writing the book now, that sort of looking back at that trip in 2008, the picture that he was seeing of that country, Pakistan, was very similar to the country that we've become now, where outsiders were vilified, where there was very little reliance in reputable sources of news, where conspiracy theories were run amok, where inequality was rampant. And so that's really, you know, the perspective that the narrator is bringing to even his parents' homeland is to say America is on a route, on a trajectory, and on a path which perhaps Americans don't quite see how treacherous it is.
I want to touch on a couple of key events that drive the real life narrative and the narrative in the book, including how people treated Muslims, or even people they thought were Muslims, after 9/11, the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Can you reflect on that a little?
Sure. I mean, I hope this is not new news. I mean, it's mm-hmm. this is kind of, it's hard to be still talking about this 19 years later. You know what I mean? It's like, I think everybody knows how Muslims have been treated in this country since 9/11. And, you know, what's unfortunate is that in many ways, not only are Muslims often seen as the perpetrators of 9/11, of course, which is ridiculous. I mean, it's true that there were 19 individuals who perpetrated them. They happened to be Muslim. And yes, there was an anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist mentality behind it. And there was a deeper reaction to American foreign policy that the attacks were a result of in large part. But by the same token, just paint the entire Muslim community with that broad brush is you know, patently absurd. And the fact that we are still having this conversation is unfortunate. And it's one, frankly, I don't even really want to talk about anymore.
We're talking to author Ayad Akhtar about his latest novel, Homeland Elegies. It draws in part from his own life, including growing up here in Wisconsin. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you have questions or thoughts for our author, 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ayad Akhtar. His most recent novel is Homeland Elegies. It draws on his experiences growing up in Wisconsin as a child of immigrants from Pakistan. Ayad, a lot of the book has to do with the rise of Donald Trump. Donald Trump shows up as a character in parts of the book. Can you talk about how that 2015-2016 election and the years since play their way in the book?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the goal behind writing the book and what the book ultimately is kind of a portrait of our country and a portrait of our country in the 21st century, really a country coming apart at the seams, and not just politically, but a country where infrastructure has collapsed, where industry has collapsed, where the economics, the ideology of accumulation of wealth and the splitting of the spoils amongst individuals and the selling off of our national infrastructure, really something that began in the 80s, has taken a toll on the entire country and most definitely in the heartland. You know, a good part of the book takes place in Wisconsin. And one of the industries that I sort of focus on is my father in the book, but also my real father's business, which was healthcare. And I sort of track how the advent of, you know, business degrees and administrators who are making decisions about patient care because spreadsheets have become much more important in the process of healthcare than anything else, and how this has created dissension within rural communities. And it's also, in a sense, kind of tearing apart the fabric of healthcare itself. So it's what I'm trying to do is tell the story of what's happened to America and why Donald Trump's ascension into power is really not the cause of this disarray, but really a symptom of it.
A running theme in the book is our relationship to money and your own. Ayad in the book goes from being somebody who's almost forced into bankruptcy because of a car breakdown by Scranton, Pennsylvania, to a fairly successful author and investor. Talk about the world of money through your own eyes and Ayad's eyes in the book.
So, yeah, and one of the things that I'm trying to to outline or sort of tell in a vivid and hopefully seductive and interesting way is the story of the American Dream, a writer who does come to make it. But again, the thesis of the book is that in some fundamental way, achieving the American Dream is no longer sufficient. You know, me getting mine and me succeeding in my life is no longer a worthy pursuit for us as individuals, as Americans. We've got to start thinking about what's good for all of us. We've got to start asking the question legislatively, philosophically, collectively, what is our collective good? So in a way, the book does track the story that you talked about, but ultimately it's to sort of reveal in a way how hollow even my own personal success or the narrator's personal success is when it comes to the larger questions of our political landscape and our future as a nation.
If I can spoil toward the end of the book here, Ayad in the book is asked in a sort of panel discussion after, you know, critiques of the United States and some of the problems you raise, why the person asks you or book Ayad anyway, why do you stay here? How do you answer a question like that?
You know, it's funny. I did an event the other night with Boswell Books in Milwaukee sponsored by Milwaukee Rep. And somebody asked me that question, said, you know, tell me a country where it's better. You know, and I thought, this is a very funny comment. You know, since when, if we were talking about the Green Bay Packers, who would be talking about, tell me what team is better? I mean, we can always be better, right? Isn't that the point? The point is to try to get better. So if people perceive criticism as something that makes them wonder why the critic is even speaking, it sounds to me that that's really committing to a losing strategy, whether you're talking about a team or a nation. We've got to figure out what's going wrong with our country, because a lot is going wrong with it. So I kind of reject the question out of hand, which I do in the book as well. The narrator does in the book as well.
You were talking about the need, Ayad, for that collective vision of the common good, given all the divisions in the United States that you've talked about there, and everybody, I think, knows about at this point. Do you see a path from here to there?
I hope so, and I don't think it's going to happen without sacrifice. You know, I have a very good friend who's a wonderful writer by the name of John Guare, a couple of generations older than me. He said in his lifetime, the major change in his lifetime is they stopped the draft and they gave us all credit cards. And I think that on some fundamental level, that really is the issue, that the individual's well-being has been privileged over the collective good. And I don't know how we get back to that, but I think we've got to continue to recognize, or we've got to begin to recognize, that that really is the fundamental problem. We can't build our society around everybody's right to do whatever they want, whether it's to make as much money as they want, or have the guns that they want, or use whatever bathroom that they want. It's not sufficient basis for a collective agreement and for collective flourishing.
Ayad, that's a good place to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ayad Akhtar is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and playwright. He joined us to talk about his newest book, Homeland Elegies. It draws heavily on his family's experiences living in Wisconsin. Coming up, the latest UW-Madison Battleground poll looking at Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania is out today. We check out the results and the state of the campaign. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This week, the UW-Madison Elections Research Center wrapped up its third major survey of registered and likely voters in key battleground states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, looking at the presidential race. The polling was done in collaboration with the Wisconsin State Journal. Results were just released earlier today. The short version, Democratic challenger Joe Biden still leads incumbent Republican Donald Trump in all three states, but not by a huge margin. Mike Wagner is a professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. He's also part of the Elections Research Center. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, break down those results a little further for us, Mike. What do we see in these three really key states?
So first we can go through registered voters. And there in Michigan, Joe Biden has a 50-42 lead over Donald Trump. In Pennsylvania, 49-44. And in Wisconsin, also that same number, 49% to 44%. That's among registered voters. Among likely voters, it's a little bit more narrow. There in Wisconsin, Biden has a 4-point lead as compared to a 5-point lead, and his 8-point lead in Michigan drops to 6. So a little bit of a tightening when we just consider likely voters in the poll, but good news for Joe Biden across the board, but not so good that he ought to feel comfortable that he's got this sewn up in these states.
And that's a good point. From how polling works, even if this pretty consistent Biden lead in those three states held up in polls until Election Day, the way margins of error and things like that work, it is not at all a lock, even if those numbers stay consistent for Biden, right?
That's right. The election has been extraordinarily consistent for more than a year in national polling. Biden's lead has been relatively stable for a very long time, from before he was actually the official nominee of the party. And the polling in Wisconsin and these other states has been fairly stable as well, with the typical narrowing the closer that we get to Election Day.
That said, even though a four-point lead isn't a lock, if I'm a candidate, I'm happier 4 points up than 4 points down, right?
Would much rather be in the lead, that's for sure.
Now let's look at what motivated voters. That was an interesting part of the poll. You looked at the issues that motivated Biden voters, the issues that motivated Trump voters. Let's start on the Biden side. What were some of the top issues the people who said they're going to vote for Joe Biden were raising?
Overwhelmingly, it's the coronavirus outbreak. Almost half of Biden voters say that's the most important issue facing the country right now. Healthcare, climate change, and inequality, which I think we could mostly interpret as racial inequality, although we could also think about economic inequality. Those were also the kind of the top issues. Each of those had a little bit more than 10% of voters who were for Joe Biden saying that that's their number one issue. But for Biden voters, it's really the coronavirus that's their top priority right now.
And then for Trump supporters, what did we hear from them on issues that were important to them?
The economy was number one. 37% of Trump voters said that was the issue that was most important to them. And then crime was second. And this is really an example of just the two completely different worlds Biden and Trump voters appear to be observing right now. 24% of Trump voters said crime was their most important issue. Only 2% of Biden voters. 47% of Biden voters said the coronavirus outbreak was their number one. Only 13% of Trump voters. And so it's not just that they have different focuses, but that the difference between them is so striking.
Talking to Mike Wagner from UW-Madison. He's part of the Elections Research Center. We're looking at the new Battleground poll just out today, looking at three really important states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania in the presidential race. Well, Mike, that last point you made fits into a lot of the research I know you and colleagues have been doing for a long time now, and I think planning to do a long time in the future. The concept of a partisan divide among voters, not just in their opinions, but kind of in the reality they live in based on things like the media they consume and who they talk to. Can you talk about that and how it fits into what you see when you ask questions like, what issue matters to you, Trump voter? What issue matters to you, Biden voter?
Yeah, we see these kinds of differences with respect to the kinds of news people use. We see that voters who favor Joe Biden prefer, hearing news on the radio. They prefer hearing or they prefer major national newspapers. They use social media a little bit more. Trump supporters and Biden supporters both use local television news in roughly the same amount. But Trump supporters tend to really listen to conservative talk radio, which is not something that Biden voters tend to do very much of. And so people are living, or some people at least, are living in really different information streams. Those tend to be the most deeply polarized among us. Whereas the folks who are having a wider range of a media diet, so to speak, are the folks who are more likely to split their ticket when they vote, as compared to voting that straight party line. And so a lot of it has to do with just where people get their information. But Republicans and Democrats are different across a whole host of attitudes, from news use to the kinds of restaurants they frequent, to the kinds of movies they like, to the kinds of humor they prefer.
Let's talk about undecided voters in the three states surveyed here. Are they a really common breed of humanity right now?
There are not many of them, in the single digits at most right now in key states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. Most folks know what they think. Most folks have known what they've thought for a very long time. But those who are undecided are, the kinds of folks who might be swayed by something that happens very late in the election season. It might be a debate. It might be a flood of advertising. It might be some kind of, October surprise. But there aren't many of them. But when the election is as close as it's likely to be in a state like ours, it doesn't take many people to change the outcome.
Let's talk about those move the needle types of events, because it's been stable, as you say, through, you know, mass nationwide protests, this huge pandemic that we're going to be writing about in history books in years to come. Joe Biden and President Trump have said a lot of words, controversial sometimes. Nothing seems to move the needle. Is there any reason to think that, say, a debate or three debates, for that matter, is going to really change that much?
I think the smartest and most likely expectation is that these things won't change voter attitudes very much. If there are changes in the polls, it may well be that undecided voters have finally heard enough enough to make a decision about who it is they're going to support, or folks who were trying to decide if they were going to turn out to vote in the first place do make that decision. I'm going to do it. I'm going to cast my vote this year. And so those are areas where we could see little bits of change. But this has been a very stable election season in terms of the preferences expressed by people when we've asked them who they want to vote for.
Let's talk about favorability of the two candidates, because a notable demographic in the 2016 election was people who didn't like Hillary Clinton and didn't like Donald Trump, and they were kind of deciding who they disliked less, I guess, if I'm saying that right. Do you have a sense of favorability for either or both candidates?
I think the Trump favorability is very similar to what it was in 2016. People really, really like him or really, really dislike him for the most part. Whereas the Biden's favorability is a little bit better than Clinton's was in 2016, and he's performing better in some different demographics than she was during that time, even as she led the popular vote and even as she led many of the polls right here in Wisconsin. He's doing a little bit better with a variety of different groups, and he has also not lost support in terms of voters shifting who they're for over the course of the last month.
A couple other interesting things you asked about in this survey. First of all, how people are planning to vote in person versus by mail. Anything stand out to you there?
Yeah, the partisan difference. It seems like Democrats are way more interested in being able to vote by mail than Republicans are. And then that's not super surprising when we think about the leader of the Republican Party, the president of the United States, saying that he doesn't trust voting by mail. And so even though there's no evidence that voting by mail has any more problems with its veracity than any other kind of voting, the president is really railing against it. And Democrats really seem to prefer it as compared to Republicans in this election cycle.
We do see President Trump encouraging Republican voters in Florida to vote by mail lately. I think answering concerns by Republicans in Florida that he might be discouraging turnout by mail for their voters. Have we seen similar messaging here in Wisconsin? Republicans saying, no, we can still vote by mail.
I've seen that from some state Republicans who I think have been more vocal about the different avenues afforded to people to vote in the state, but from the president, who himself, cast a vote through the mail in Florida, no less, is not doing that same kind of encouraging of his supporters to vote for him through that particular mechanism of voting.
And something I haven't seen in a lot of surveys, you also asked about how likely voters were contacted, whether they'd been contacted by campaigns directly by mail, email. Anything stand out to you there?
Yeah, I was. It was interesting to notice that there, Biden voters were a little bit more likely to get contacted in Michigan and Pennsylvania, but Trump voters were more likely to report being contacted in Wisconsin among likely voters. And so 70% of Trump voters said they'd been contacted in Wisconsin, as compared to 59% of Biden voters in the state. And, you know, almost two out of three Wisconsinites said they've been contacted by both parties, which I think speaks to how cheap it is now to use social media and texting and other, you know, affordances to try to contact voters as compared to sending mail, which is a little bit more expensive.
In our last few moments, Mike, what are you watching for next as this campaign goes on?
Well, I'll be interested to see how the issues related to Justice Ginsburg's death are interpreted by the public to see if that is something that motivates more folks on the left. Folks on the right had already been motivated by opportunities to vote for Supreme Court judges, and we knew a little bit about that from data in 2016. And so we'll see if that moves the needle. And then by the same token, there's been a little bit of a narrowing in support for some of the racial justice protest movements in Wisconsin over the last month. And so I'll be curious to see if that stabilizes or continues the trend that it's been moving in.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. My pleasure.
Mike Wagner is a professor of mass communication at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about results from the latest UW Elections Research Center polling in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. They show Joe Biden with a consistent lead over President Trump, but not an overwhelming lead over the president in all three states. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, millions of working women have put their careers on hold during the pandemic. It's had a big impact, and it could have after effects that last a long time. Find out more today at 6 here on the Ideas Network.